Hi, and welcome to the Curb Podcast. My name is Andrew Pierce, and I'm recording this podcast on the lands of the Whadjuk people of Perth region. Sovereignty never ceded. On this episode, I chat with director Lucia Schmidt about her stunning documentary Train to Sea, which is screening at the Castlemaine Documentary Film Festival. It will launch at the in-person screening on June 17th, with online sessions available to everyone in Australia afterwards to rent. Train to Sea tells the story of three American women journalists, Martha Gellhorn, Lee Miller, and Margaret Burke White, who each documented the Second World War in a fearless manner, putting themselves on the front line to capture their stories. Throughout Train to Sea, we hear their stories from correspondents and journals that they kept during the period, and ultimately get to see the difficulties that they faced as the power of misogyny arose during the war. This is both a powerful and engaging film, and it is one of the finest archival documentaries of the year. As mentioned, Train to Sea is available to watch for Australian audiences via cdocff.com.au. I'll stick a link in the show notes, alongside other great films, including the brilliant football-focused documentary Equal the Contest, directed by Mitch Navalis, and tells about their journey to push for equality in Aussie football. Other films available to watch online are Watanda, My Countrymen, The Thief Collector, Into the Ice, Weed and Wine, and Young Plato. For more information about the festival and to read interviews with Mitch Navalis and festival director Claire Jager, visit thecurb.com.au. For now, here's the trailer to Train to Sea, and followed by my discussion with Lucia Schmidt.
This is going to be a nice long war. Sooner or later, they're going to want to make it popular. And then folks like us can work. The world is moving along at such an exciting pace that I want to be right there, photographing it every possible minute of the year.
I was the only photographer for miles around, and I now owned a private war.
It belongs to us, because I am involved in mankind. I'm never sure of what I'm going to do, or sometimes even aware of what I do. Only that I want that picture.
It is such a really powerful, powerful film. So you've done a stellar job of creating and pulling together a very emotional story, but also one that needs to be told about these great women who, to be honest, I was not really aware of their true stories, like of their history.
Same here. Yeah.
So with that in mind, how did you come to those stories then?
Actually, it was there was an exhibition in Berlin, and along with that, and it was about, I think it was with photographs. I haven't seen it myself, but it was with photographs by Lee and Margaret Burke White, and there was a text by a female historian professor from Zurich. Her name is Edith Bromfen, and she made an essay. She wrote an essay about, and she was the first one to put these three women together. So Martha Gellhorn, Margaret Burke White, and Lee Miller, and just putting them in one piece and sort of comparing them. And then, and I'm Cologne-based, but my producer and the two producers, Katarina and Uli, saw the exhibition and thought that would be a great topic. And then they addressed me if I wanted to make a movie. And then I read a first idea and I said, yes, I'd love to do it, but only not with experts and sons and, you know, interviews and people saying, Lee was a very important photographer at the time, and you wouldn't believe, but she did work with Man Ray and was best friends with Picasso. So this I knew I really didn't want to do. And I said, I'd like to do it, but only with their own words, like if it really only quote their own. And then we started research.
So let's go down that research path then, because there is some really powerful imagery here. And then we're talking about I think it's Margaret who had to search at the Pentagon for lost pictures too. So I imagine getting the imagery and getting the writing must have taken quite a bit of time, and a lot of high-level places you must have visited as well. So what was that journey like?
So we started working on the film in 2017, and of course financing took ages. So as it usually does, but okay. You get one fund, but you don't get the other one. So you go back to zero. So that was, but what I knew was I have worked with previous films on World War II issues, but just like it would be smaller parts of a film. And then I would go through this archive footage, which is in Germany. It's called NARA. It's the National Archives. So this is public domain. So basically that is affordable money and it's affordable footage, and it's just the footage we needed because it's only the US, the perspective of US Air Forces. And usually when I would work with these pictures, I would think, oh, why do I always have to cut away when it starts to be interesting for me, you know? So you would always go for the three basic images you need. And I felt, and now I used to get lost in this kind of archival footage. So that was the first thing. I knew there was footage and that was really good and it would be suitable for the pictures I would need. And so it was always the two sides. It was, I would gather as many texts as I could and I would start to read their texts. And then at the same time, I had these pictures in mind. I knew they existed. And of course, there were the photographs. And there was the financing period. So it was all kind of a work in, it was all going simultaneously. And then COVID came. So we went to see, first before COVID, we went to see the Lee Miller estate and her son. And we went to see the stepson of Martha Gellhorn. They're both based in Southern England. So that was okay for us. But the whole footage or all of the, like her whole erbe, what's it called again? The whole archive of Magdeburg White, she donated it after she died. She passed away to Syracuse University. So all that was there. And the letters from Martha and a lot of other stuff was in different US archives. There was one in Boston. There was, of course, her conversation with Mrs. Roosevelt was in the Roosevelt Library. There was some in the Hemingway archive. So that became an issue once we had the problem, once we faced COVID. So all of the archives, including Onara archive, were just shut. So that gave us more time and financing, really. And so I started to just really work with what I had, and I would prepare. I was going through like her biography. There were biographies on all of the three women. So, and they would work with quotes, and then they'd have the index at the end of the book, and they would say it's taken from that and that letter. So I would search all the texts with meaningful I sentences, so where you could feel it is an I, it's their own perspective, I feel like, or it felt to me like blah 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 blah. So I was looking for all kinds of sentences or phrases or articles that had this strong I perspective, and then I would create interviews with each one of them. I would just put all these little pieces together and say, okay, I built my own interview. And once I had, and just in order to get their story straight, and then I would, start to write a script, like to combine the three stories, to interweave them on paper, since there was no material, there was no footage. And my editor, she said, and then we would listen, we would read the book or the book, or we and then I had friends of mine read it. So I it wasn't only written, so we would have an idea of, and then we would edit this, and then this would be like 3 hours, and my editor said, you only get to give me 2 hours. That's the utmost, because just with given the time we had for editing and given the time, the finances we had for editing, it was clear, and also just to keep it reasonable. It was such an insane amount of work. Just to keep this insane amount in a yet still reasonable volume. And so I shortened it down to 2 hours, and then it went to the editing room, and we had a wonderful research archive person in the US, and she was really familiar with that narrow kind of, with that narrow footage. So even though the archive was closed, she knew in her head what was there. And she said, listen, there's so much footage. You just really need to get yourself together. You need to tell me what you need from what period. And this, of course, again, was helpful, because then I would tell her, I need spring 43 at the Liri Valley. So, or at the, well, the Southern Italy campaign. So that's, it was really a great co-work process. I mean, any film is just like only possible if you have a great team. But I think that's what everybody says, but also with this team, especially, we just were really, we were a good team, and we worked together really, really well.
It's a long, long experience of putting it all together, and it shows on screen. Not only like the teamwork and everything like that, that you're working with the editor and all the archivists, but there is almost this conversation that you're having with the women themselves, as if you are bringing their stories to a modern context and making us consider the work that they did and in a modern context as well. And I'm curious if you can talk about what it means to have these stories out there in the world today. Is there a personal connection to those stories at all? Is there something that draws you to wanting to be able to bring them back to life now?
The first thing was I wanted it to feel contemporary. So, I mean, you always choose. That's what you basically do as a director. If you're looking for your story, you need to find what you're interested in. And I was always looking, and I said also when we, in the editing process, when we had to still narrow it down, whatever feels contemporary, I want to take that in. So I think like her comments on like Martha's comments on nationalism and patriotism, there's so much up to date. Or if you have Margaret Bourgeois talking about how she feels after she spoke to Hildegard Roselius, and this is just talking about fake information and misinformation nowadays. You can put it on any conflict or on any government that chooses to not inform its people. So that was a crucial issue. And then for me, I'm Swiss, but I live in Germany. So I guess that makes a difference. I'm not saying that the Swiss weren't involved in World War II, but to me, World War II is always present. And my children are German, so, and my husband is German. So I have lots of love. So it's not a question about guilt or blame, but it's still such a heavy heritage. It's such a burden, and it's still present. And at the same time, we have also in Germany, we have this right-wing movement becoming more and more like influential and stronger, the AfD. It's called Alternative for Germany. And I think it was in 2017, or shortly after we started working on a film, that this one said, well, let's get over with that remembering World War II and the Holocaust and stop blaming ourselves. It was a flyshit in history, so in the German history. So regarding all of the German history, it was just a flyshit. And I felt like, hang on, I'm not only me, it was a big debate in Germany. And also it's a bit the debate that the survivors of the Holocaust, they start, like the last one would be dying soon because they're really old. So how to memorize what happened. And also, again, with my children going to school in Germany, you know, I also from myself, but also from their school, they do learn about World War II and the Holocaust and Shoah and everything. But I realized we have like a certain set of images that allows us to deal with the Holocaust and the terror of it and the dimension of it. Like one of them is even the pictures like Margaret Bourgeois created, like these iconic pictures of the in Buchenwald, of the inmates of Buchenwald behind barbed wire within their striped dresses or pajamas or what one should call them. And I felt, okay, this is like, we have this, it's like a canon of pictures. And this allows us to digest sort of, to deal with the dimension. And I felt maybe it's time to go back to really get into what it was like. I mean, what the real, you know, to not allow us to go look at Holocaust with that certain set of, let's say, 10 pictures that we learn and that we have in mind. And also with, you know, with that, whenever I've seen the movie because we had a nice festival. We did well on festivals, so I did have the chance to, you know, you go there, you make the Q&A, and then usually I would come back at the last part of the film. So it's always the pictures from Dachau and Buchenwald, so the concentration camps in Leipzig. And each time I feel like, oh my God, this is just too much. But then again, we were really discussing this issue. How much is too much? How much is it too much? Is it too little? Is it just right? It's a discussion. But I felt if you decide to really, really, like I did, I really wanted to have the personal, the subjective perspective of the women. And then you have to go, and I wanted to go their journey all the way to what I call the darkest heart of Germany in World War II. And this was the concentration camps. And this is what, like it was for them, you know, they would race along, as Margaret says, they would race along the front. It would be very quickly. It would be stressful. It would be exciting. It would be celebrating. And it would be yet another day, another camp. They would have to, you know, they shared apartment at one point in Cologne, but then they would. So it was just a crazy, crazy time. And in the middle of this crazy time, they would end up in Buchenwald and be confronted with the dimension of Buchenwald. And then they would go on and it would be another place. It would be Torgau. It would be this. And then yet another concentration camp. So I felt I had to go with them on their journey and to make it as subjective as possible, like how they survived it. This is also why I decided to put Leipzig Mokau in it, because as Margaret says, this is when it hit her. She would take picture on a professional level in Buchenwald, but then she went to that other small, it wasn't a concentration camp, it was a labor camp. And also these labor camps, it's something you don't really, you think of the concentration camps, of the mass destruction camps, but there were many, many labor camps with terrible conditions. So, and just as awful, or in another way, as awful as the concentration camp. And also the picture from Lee Miller, you know, if you think like this very iconic picture of her in Hitler's bathtub, I mean, this is the one Lee Miller picture everybody knows, if they know Lee Miller. But then I felt you can't show this picture without really pointing out that she's literally washing up the dust of Dachau in his bathtub. So you really need to go there in order to get a sense of what Dachau really was like.
And it's painful. When I visited Germany, this is a long time ago, but I visited Dachau, and having those photos as well, it just took me back to the place and getting to experience the way that trauma and tragedy resonates through time. It's quite a painful thing. And that's why I'm grateful that you do have those images in there, because of the fact that, you know, in Australia at least, it was only a few weeks ago that in Melbourne they had Nazis on the steps of Parliament House, you know, and we need to be reminded of the lineage of where this originated from, and your film in some capacity does that too. But I want to kind of pivot to, as much as I can, to a lighter thing, which is talking about, I think it's Lee Miller who is doing the sequence where, or no, it's Margaret, I think, possibly, where they're talking about capturing the different angles of the different machinations of war, and talking about, you know, I need to capture the photos of, you know, the battle of loading the bullet.
Oh, okay.
Firing the bullet and all this kind of stuff. And in some capacity, she is actually becoming a leader in herself in saying, you know, load, ready, fire.
I love that.
There's a real
bit,
joy
yeah.
in that sequence. And I wonder if you can talk about discovering that and what it means to be able to present that on screen, and also directing the voice actor to what kind of directions you possibly gave them to give that energy there as well.
I can relate to some extent to these women. They really wanted to do they really wanted to go to war. And I mean, war reporting has a fascination in itself because it's there where action is, where history is happening. I think even when I started, I felt like there was some, oh, this was way before Ukraine war. But, and I'm not saying I was, I sense it ahead. But I was sometimes I wonder, and I was thinking, it's like there is a new kind of fascination for war uprising. It's like we forgetting how terrible it was. And also, you know, we like the news, you look at war, what you get to see is the war pictures, the uglier, the better. Not the uglier, the better, but it has to be action. Or war films, it captures attention. And there's some fascinating aspect to it, knowing that it's a dark, dark, dark thing. And I felt that was interesting to show their way, really, how they were. I mean, Margaret Bourke White, she was really patriotic. They all had a very different attitude towards war and how they wanted to get into it. And Margaret Bourke White, she was a real tech freak, as we would say here. I mean, when she started photographing, she was the first one, and she studied so hard until she got it right to make industrial pictures of the process of melting steel. And this was in her early 20s. So when she taught herself, and she was such a tech freak, she was really good at all the technical aspects of photographing. And as she says in the film, in the very big, if she wants a picture, she does everything to get it. And I thought that was a really great aspect. And when I read her report on how she loved it, and this story in her real report, it goes on and on and on. And finally the general came along, and he was like, and everybody came, you know, watching how she did it. And I think this is just also a part of the truth. They loved their job and they really wanted to go there, and they loved to be among the soldiers and at the front line. And she wanted to do her best because she was very good at what she was doing, and she always wanted to deliver the best she had. And by the way, she wasn't particularly well liked among her male colleagues, of course, because she was so driven, because she really knew how to get what she wanted. And so she wasn't the best liked comrade amongst her fellow life photographers. But I like that aspect because she, and also especially because I feel that each of these women, they have their own journey towards war, and they have their own motivation why they want to go to war and why they want to be frontline or war reporters. And once they get in touch with war, they realize in a very painful way, you never go to war without leaving it injured. It's not necessarily physically, but psychologically. They all had big issues after it.
I understand that for some of them, there was that reluctance to actually talk about it afterwards. And there was this reluctance to explore what they went through and what they witnessed as well with their families. You know, there's obviously, I won't get too much into it for people who haven't seen the film, but there are some people who, you know, hid what they went through from their families for so long. And what I appreciate so much about your film is that it encourages us to recognize the hard work that they went through, but also to witness that, you know, the trauma and the tragedy that they also went through as well, because it is such a hard thing to go through. Which again leads me back to the voice actors that you've got. I'm curious about what kind of direction that you gave them to inhibit these women so vividly and so powerfully.
Well, I guess they were good. That helps. And I think I just wanted, they realized it was not a documentary in the sense of a documentary. You have this over voice going, oh, do, do, this is happening, do, do, do. But I wanted them, and that's what I asked them, I wanted them to speak it as if it was their own thoughts, as if they were living it at the time. So I really wanted this acting part to be shown in the film, not overdoing it. I think that was the process of finding out, not overdoing it, but still really feeling that they are incorporating this very character, so be it Martha, Margaret, or Lee, so that each of them would be this person and would try to feel as they, if they were going through the moment right now. Just, I mean, I guess that's, I'm a documentary maker, so I'm not so familiar with the actors, but I guess that's what is what acting is all about. So,
as we lead into wrapping up, and I've really appreciated having the time to be able to talk with you about the film, of course, it's going to be screening at the Castlemaine Documentary Festival. And I'm curious what that means to be able to have this story and your film screening in Australia. What is that, something that excites you, or being able to reach an audience like this in Australia?
Absolutely. Because when I, you know, if you grow up in Europe, you learn about Second World War and you know all about it. You feel you know all about it. But when I got back into this, I realized, oh my God, there were also soldiers from Australia fighting to liberate Europe and fighting to liberate Germany. And this is such an incredible cost the world paid, like the Allied world paid to free Europe. And I think this is, this really hit me. Like also when she said, like the Canadian, we showed it at the Hot Dogs Toronto Festival, and Canada is not quite as far away, but still very far away. And this moment when Martha says the Canadians broke the Gothic line, it felt like, as if I felt like, oh, right, these are the Canadians. We are in Canada. And it's the same with Australia. There were so many Australian soldiers fighting either in Europe or then also in the Pacific, but also in Europe. And I feel it's very important to remember at what tremendous cost Europe was freed and democracy was reinstalled in Germany. And I don't know if gratefulness is the right perspective nowadays, and 75 years later, not having lived through it and everything, but still there is a sense of being grateful or respect for that united force, or like that united commitment to do this. And I have, even though I felt I was well informed about World War II, I was shocked by realizing also the Italian war, you know, the campaign, how terrible it was.
I mean, as you're saying, 75 years, it's a long time, but it's still so present. It's still so present in our lives. And we, you know, not a week goes by where we are still discovering stories that took place during that time. And that's what, to me, at least, Train to See is. For a lot of people, it's a discovery of the stories that these women are telling. And I'm so grateful that you brought it into existence and brought their stories to life, because I feel richer and better for having learned about their stories. And I know after I watched it, I spent ages looking at different photos and just sitting with them and looking at, you know, the moments that has been captured. They're so vivid and real, and the photography is so brilliant, and knowing that it was done under such extreme moments is really powerful and brilliant. So I'm grateful that you've brought this to life, and I'm grateful that we're getting to experience this story in Australia now. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me and the film, of course. Yeah.